Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com for comprehensive show notes, infographics, book suggestions, or to just leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast. And get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. And here's Brent.
Everybody's felt angry. If you're not angry, it's like if you don't have that reaction, you're not human. If you're not sad, if you don't mourn for the loss of all the lives and productivity and opportunity that statism has cost us. But then what do we do with that? We go out on the street corner with our signs and our bullhorns and yell, "Now join me in my anger and my fear and my depression." Everybody says, "Screw you. I'm so guilty of this myself." And yeah. The kind of ego-driven, headline-grabbing activism that I'm known for is what comes out of that negativity. But when you get it from, wow, hey, this is something beautiful that I figured out that's made my life better. By the way, it could solve a lot of the world's problems, but hey, do you want to be happier and more free? No one's going to come back with, oh, happy and free? I don't know about that. Who's going to build the roads?
Yeah.
You just don't get that objection anymore.
Today is July 13th. Welcome back to School Sucks. I'm Brett. And are you ready for another busy week of podcasting? Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Well, ready or not, here it comes. Pow. In the radio business, they call that a stinger. And I'm looking to work more of them into the show in the future. So today, Adam Kokash, some of you might be saying, Brett, I thought I remember hearing you say something about not being a very big fan of Adam Kokash. Yeah, on the show in the past, we've been very critical of his activism, parts of his activism anyway. There are parts of it that I certainly always enjoyed watching on YouTube, but a lot has changed. And I'm actually pretty impressed and even inspired by some of the things that Adam is doing these days. And I'm looking forward to checking back with him in the near future to see how some of his upcoming projects unfold and progress. So if you stay tuned, we will get into all that in the show today. Up this Wednesday, Professor Crispin Sartwell. And by Friday, hopefully by Friday, we will have the first installment in our series responding to the Gnostic media videos on nonviolent communication and mind control. There it is. All right, everybody. I hope your week is off to a good start. Let's get into our conversation. Today, we will cover Adam's personal evolution currently in progress. I'll share with him some of the details of mine. We talk about his book, Freedom, and the ongoing Campfire Freedom Tour, which is what brought him to my city, Manchester, New Hampshire. We then move on to self-esteem, letting go of negativity, and nonviolent communication. I want to thank everybody who submitted questions. We got to a few of them, a few more we answered indirectly. Thanks for listening. Here we go. Adam Kokash, how you doing?
It's been a while, man.
Enough time for a lot to change.
No kidding. We've both come so far.
Thank you. I think it was like 2 years ago, almost to the day, that your house was raided. You were taken out. Fairfax County Jail?
Yeah.
2 days, 2 years ago yesterday.
Yeah.
And it was about a little more than 1 year ago that you put out your book, Freedom.
Yep. Independence Day, 2014.
And you wrote that while you were incarcerated, right?
At least started it. I should just go with that. Yeah, of course. I wrote it while I was in jail. It sounds nicer, doesn't it? But the more important point of this was that during my government-induced, taxpayer-funded spiritual retreat in a beautiful manicured facility, gated community with 24-hour security. I mean, I really enjoyed my time in the D.C. jails and in Virginia, actually. The idea for the book came to me. And once I had the idea, the book kind of wrote itself. You know, I don't want to make it sound like it was that easy, but being able to look back and do a survey of the literature of the freedom movement as broadly defined, going back to Plato and Socrates, to Locke, to Adams, to Spooner, to Mises, to Hayek, to Rand, to Rothbard, to Dr. Paul, to, I mean, there's so many others I'm forgetting and leaving out, Konkin even, Bastiat, right? You know, and seeing what had been done in all of the ways that people had tried to communicate the message of freedom. And what I've learned from my experience traveling around the country, not just on this tour, but, you know, as an activist before this, I started in, oh my God, make me feel old, 2007 with Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Right.
And what I've learned is that the way people wake up is not by getting yelled at a bar.
Oh, no, you're kidding.
I know. All those libertarians yelling at people at bars, wasting their time. Who would have guessed? They don't wake up from Facebook flame wars. I know. Shocking. Memes don't do it. Nobody said, oh, I saw that meme on Facebook, and that raised the cognitive dissonance that made me a libertarian. I sat on it, and I thought about it, and I figured it out. And I was like, okay, I guess I believe in freedom. It doesn't work that way.
So don't keep us in suspense, though.
What does it do?
Yeah, exactly.
What does it? Well, right.
A
lot of people have this mythology, a personal mythology of what woke them up. And most people know me outside of our movement from the Jefferson Dance Party video when I got body slammed by the cops for dancing.
Right.
And I love hearing people tell me, even like years later, that was what woke me up. And they'll say that that's what started it for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you look past those, you know, apocryphal, mythological moments of enlightenment, what really is the conversion is not that. Those things can spark it or start it.
Escalate it or accelerate it.
Accelerate it or motivate it. And more often than being exposed to something in media, it's a personal experience. It's, I got that ticket and I didn't like the way the cop looked at me. And something was wrong. Or my cousin went to jail for pot, and I saw how it destroyed his life.
Mm-hmm.
Or I was on probation, and while chafing under the system of probation was like, wait a second, something's seriously wrong, and I got to figure it out. But the figuring it out, that's the real waking up. That's the real settling in the acceptance. And it comes from quiet reflection and consideration of the message as a whole.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, it almost seems for most of us, for me anyway, there certainly needed to be some kind of knowledge foundation there that makes those kinds of events make sense. You know, so I mean, I went to college. I graduated from college very liberal. I was a Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky kind of guy. But it was at least like this distrust of authority seed that mm-hmm. was planted that years later, like when I was working at a boarding school and giving kids drugs, I started to notice, like, who are we helping here? You know, like working for a private school where kids
right.
were in state custody and then brought to us and having this really idealistic vision of how the state helps people. I mean, all these kids are on Medicaid being taken care of and all that.
So that cognitive dissonance then motivated you to go find the bottom of the rabbit hole to resolve those contradictions, right?
Eventually,
Now, you've heard the analogy before, I'm sure, of the flat earth versus round earth.
Yeah, where do you come down on that debate?
Right. Well, no. Yeah. I'm really one of the ovular types in this
right.
one. But no, the when people thought that the world was flat,
mm-hmm.
they could explain the motion of the sun and the moon around it, but it kind of made sense. And they thought that that was the center of the universe. But then they had to make all these crazy equations up to explain the movements of all the other planets and everything else they saw in the sky, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden someone came along and said, wait a second. Maybe the Earth is round and the sun is in the center of the solar system. And, well, they killed that guy. But then, after enough people said, hey, maybe he was right, they realized and they tried and they did the math. And they go, wow, everything's way simpler now. Like, all the orbits kind of make sense. All the, you know, we don't have to make all these fancy equations to explain these erratic movements. And it's like with the flat Earth model, the proposition of the Earth is flat in the center of the universe is the equivalent of government is good and righteous and moral and necessary. And when you have a really well-entrenched set of data behind that vision, behind that assertion, like for you, someone who's not just a liberal because your parents are liberal and you're 15 and you're a bleeding heart, but because you've done all of the research and you've studied all of the books and you've read Zinn and Chomsky.
I went to fucking
right?
college.
Exactly. Well, you thought about it in college, right?
So, like, well, I was told, I mean, I was a graduate of the public school system, so I sat there feeling like I was absorbing this knowledge that these professors had, but they had an agenda and I didn't have critical thinking skills.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, when I graduated in 2000, I was 21, I thought thought I was one of the smartest people in the world, you know, but it's that's what you're saying, right?
It's very humbling, isn't it, to go through such a major realignment as this. So if you're one of the astronomers mm-hmm. and you go, well, gee, let me consider this model that, you know, the Earth is the center of the universe and or the sun is the center of the solar system and the Earth travels around it and all the other planets do and it's traveling through the galaxy and here's how it makes sense with the movement of the stars, blah, blah, blah. You have to do a lot of math. And if you have a really firm vision of the old model, then it takes you a lot of time. I mean, I got to be really humble about this, too. It took me 10 freaking years to go from, even from identifying as a libertarian because of the LP, because when I was in high school, they said, you're going to vote soon. Do you want to be a Republican or Democrat? And I was like, really? I have to be totally freaking lame?
Yeah, sure.
And then there's got to be an option, right? So it was like the used car dealer taking you to the back of the lot, you know, in the corner. Oh, we don't really want anybody to see this one, and we're not really sure what happened in the back seat, but you could probably get it home. It's called the Libertarian Party. And I was like, sign me up. So mm-hmm. 10 years from that to understand it. And for the people who are really invested in it emotionally and intellectually, it's a much more difficult process. For the average person, though, and you know, we talk about this, you know, in terms of Bitcoin, and it's kind of obvious. And how do we convince people to adopt Bitcoin? Make it easy for them.
Yeah.
You know, make it better than the dollar. How much thought did the average American put into deciding whether or not to use the U.S. dollar? Zero.
Right.
How much thought do they put into being a statist? Not much more.
Right. Right.
It's very so. For people, though, to accept this new model, the more intellectual you are, the harder it is. And for a lot of people, you know, they're going to have to do it on their own. People like you and me, mm-hmm. you know, if you saw me 10 years ago, you know, maybe if you had this book, you know, you could say, no, I dare you to refute a single sentence in this and hand it to them like that. And it works as that tool. But it would take longer. For most people, what we need to do to win converts is to give them the message in a way that they can stop and think about it at their own pace, on their own time, as efficiently and as directly as possible in a way that allows them to consider the entire framework. Mm-hmm. Everybody has all the pieces. You don't need any of the data. And that's one of the things about this book that's so true to that spirit is there aren't any historical facts in here. It's not even referring to any particular government. It is the universal philosophy that applies as much to anyone in the planet living under statism as you and I.
So the book embodies that kind of communication process for you, and
yes.
I think it does a great job. And I will say that if I hadn't had the experience with you that I've had recently, like talking during Porkfest and all that, if somebody handed me this book based on what I had observed you doing, you know, 2010 through 2013, I would say Adam Kokesh didn't write this. it's not your style of it, that style of communication.
Right.
So
absolutely not. And this is to go back to when I was in jail, yeah. and it was the idea for the book. It was how do we combine all of the best elements of all of these books in a way that allows people to consider the message in its entirety as efficiently and effectively as possible, with giving them as little reason to object, mm-hmm. giving them absolutely nothing to argue with. And if we know that this is the truth, we don't need to insert opinion or conjecture or wishful thinking or negative judgments or unnecessary labels or any of the other pitfalls of the violent communication, that which is contrary to the principles of nonviolent communication. Mm-hmm. And so having come up with the idea for the book, it was a process of first deciding what goes in, what doesn't. Writing the book itself, I wrote a few sections while I was in jail, and then the rest of it I wrote in about 2 weeks. The hard part then was editing. The first version was 140 pages. We got it down to 140. I invited 300 people to edit it. About half of them actually read it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, maybe half of those provided meaningful feedback. I told people, poke as many holes in it as possible. Help me hone the language to be true to these principles. I'm not as good as this. I can't write this on my own. But if I can bring this creative process of crowdsourcing the editing to bear and really of writing it, a lot of it was rewritten. Sentence by sentence by other contributors who said, you know, maybe this would be more clear. Maybe this is more in line with the principles, Adam, with which you're trying to put this book together. Mm-hmm. So my name's not on the cover. I don't use the first person pronoun until the afterword, and my name's not mentioned until you see it tucked in the back because someone has to take responsibility for this. But it really was a collaborative effort, and I really think that this represents the most effective way to wake someone up right now. Some people will do it from a 10-minute video. You'll show some people a 10-minute YouTube video, and if that's all they really care about being engaged in the first place, they'll go, oh, okay, I get it. But it usually, even for the average person, takes just a little bit more consideration than. And if you want to change how people think, you got to make them think. So we made it as easy as possible.
And it speaks to a young audience. You know, that was what I realized when I started doing this work in 2009. Like, you know, the more people invest either intellectually or invest with time, I think that contributes to an emotional investment. Yes. So people get to be 30,
35. Oh, because it's hard to admit you're wrong.
Yeah, 35, 40 years old. Yeah. And it's like they're so less reachable than somebody who's in high school.
Yeah.
And your message is school sucks. And they're like, yeah, it kind of does. What else you got? You know? So, you know, that was my approach. And I saw that those were the people, that was the target audience. And yeah, you know, your idea of winning converts really speaks to me because it started making me ask questions like, yeah, we provide all this stuff. How many people have left public school? How many parents have taken their kids out of public school or pledged to each other and to their children never to send them to public school? Mm-hmm. I mean, those are things that are quantifiable that are really important. And that is like truly, you know, converting people, getting them to take some kind of meaningful action. And it contributes to the personal freedom of individuals. So based on the conversation we had last week, I've actually started to think about ways like how can this be quantified, you know? And
well, have we sold the book to every one of your listeners? Everyone in your audience is like, okay, the book is the book. I get it. We can talk bigger activism.
Yeah, we can.
Now.
We should talk a little bit about the book too, so, since we have time. And you know, I just listened to the audiobook. Oh yeah, go ahead.
If I may, like you said, what you said then about appealing to a younger audience.
Sure.
And I don't think anybody is unreachable, but some people are more than others. You know, every human is capable.
Right,
with enough time and therapy, some of them will die first, but every human being, at least theoretically, is capable of accepting this fundamental truth of freedom based on universal nonviolence, self-ownership, non-aggression principle, that specific truth.
Right.
But there were a couple things that I saw that were missing in all of the works that I mentioned earlier, all of those great authors, you know. So, you know, we made this book short, like Anatomy of the State by Rothbard and The Law by Bastiat being exactly 100 pages. We made it as comprehensive as something like For a New Liberty, which is 400 pages, and Ethics of Liberty, which was really the book that did it for me by Rothbard. Ethics of Liberty was it. 400 pages, though. You can't hand that to a high school kid.
Right. And so this is like all the horizontal without all the vertical.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are two general areas that I added. To, you know, and I don't claim credit for the originality of anything in this book. And it's very clear. It's open source. And I say in it, you know, do what you want with it, rip it, put your name on the copy and sell, or on the cover and sell more copies. Please do it. In fact, someone has already ripped this and published it on CreateSpace on Amazon. So if you want to get it cheaper than I sell it on my website, you can get a slightly different formatted version from someone I don't know if you look for it.
Right.
But it's free in every digital format possible. It's free on our website as a PDF, as plain text, as every e-reader format, as an audiobook, as a single file, as chapters. And thanks to you, Brett, we're going to have to publish a speeded up version as well for the speed listeners.
Oh, yeah. I like 1.25.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. We'll do that. So for the people that want to take it that fast. But the two areas that were actually somewhat unique in this that weren't represented in the existing literature that was attempting to do this, to be a comprehensive presentation of the message. But one of the other features, short sections, very easy to digest. You can hand it to someone and say, read one section. Like the section on schooling obviously spoke to you, and it's just one page. It's 60 sections in 100 pages. I like soldiering. I extend that to high school kids who are considering joining the military. So far, no one who has read it yet has enlisted. And I feel like we got a perfect record on that.
That's
but
good.
The two sections that I saw were included and important to libertarians in America, in the world, to my fans at least, that weren't represented in that literature were the issues of happiness and freedom or emotional freedom and the issues of futurism. Mm-hmm. And by futurism, first I'll talk about the emotional happiness.
Yeah.
And that was the part that came to me in jail that was so important, that it's a fundamental truth of human existence that we can't remind ourselves of enough, that you have the power to choose your demeanor at any time. And I got this because I was happy when I was in jail. And in contrast to the guards who I told every chance I got, you're a free, beautiful, independent human being. You should never let anyone tell you otherwise. Have a nice day. Mm-hmm. You know, and they walk away like, whoa. And I'm sitting in solitary, you know, happy and reading fan mail and reading books and writing letters and just having a blast.
Well, how did you get there? How did you?
Oh, that was for loading a shotgun.
No.
How did I get to
How
jail?
Did you get to that state of mind?
Okay, that kind of goes back to the Marine Corps and being in Fallujah in 2004, being the guy who always woke up early to tell jokes and sing songs and tell stories and get my team in a good mood. And the Marine Corps teaches you, not everybody gets it, but a lot of Marines do, the whistle past the graveyard sense of humor. Mm-hmm. The more difficult the challenge, the more you enjoy it, the, you know, make it hurt kind of attitude. And it for me, it was touching on or getting towards that Zen state of engagement for someone who's just passionately involved and all of their talents are dedicated to something that lights them up. You know, people have that in every field of endeavors, but that's how I got it in jail. So the idea about emotional freedom, it's like if you don't know how to be happy, what's the point of being free?
Exactly.
And we talk about the negativity of this very, very openly, that government propaganda wants us to be afraid and they want us to be dependent and they want us to be beaten down and sad and angry and all this negativity that we know is being foisted upon us. And it's either be negative or check out and don't pay attention. Mm-hmm. Like that's kind of the message of the news, right? At least by one analysis. But we don't talk about the flip side, which is being impervious to that. What does it mean to be truly emotionally free? To be to not allow yourself to be subject to the kind of emotional slavery of external manipulation. And so that's covered in the book and how you can actually apply that to your life to be happier. And that makes people better activists. I mean, if you go out in fear and anger and you're trying to win converts, people are going to say, screw that. Why would I want anything to do with that? So the other thing in looking forward is something that I think has been missed in all of the literature to date, really before this, at least attempting to be a comprehensive way to convey the message. And for a lot of progressives, I mean, maybe not for people of a true conservative mindset, but of a progressive mind or liberal mindset in America. And I use progressive more than liberal because it's nice to acknowledge that of the left in America, most of the people truly are forward-thinking. They're not saying, let's preserve, let's defend, let's like maintain the status quo, which is a strain of the mentality of conservatism, not that it's everyone. But if we want to appeal to progressives who really are like, well, no, humanity's moving forward. Yeah. How are we doing this? To say technology is making us more free. It is connecting us. It is making us less violent. And one of the things that I think in terms of to transition a little bit to the bigger conversation here, is so important is a lot of libertarians don't satisfactorily answer the question for themselves, are we going to achieve a voluntary society or not, and how soon? Mm-hmm. And I've been obsessed with that question since, you know, at least I started doing Adam versus the Man, which we killed in order to kill my ego and put aside that and really be able to focus on sharing the message and putting the message first. But it's really fun to think about. And it's really reassuring, and it solves a lot of the fear. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there who get this message who come at you with, and if we don't storm the castles with the pitchforks now, it's 1,000 years of tyranny and darkness. And, by the way, buy my survival seeds and water filters.
Yep.
And that's a lot of people, you know. Alex Jones may be the embodiment of that. But they're trying to manipulate you by fear the same way. And I don't think it's ingenuine. I think those people really are in that state of fear, and that's what
they feel the urgency.
Yeah. Well, they haven't answered the question for themselves, and maybe if their business is based on scaring people and scaring people into their audience, well then they're going to shy away from taking an honest intellectual look at those questions. But if you understand freedom to require nonviolent relationships, mm-hmm. that any violence, I mean, yes, you have the right to self-defense in a free society, but if someone is attacking you and you need to defend yourself, guess what? Your freedom was violated. So there's and in a sense, you are violating someone else's freedom to defend yourself. I would say righteously and justly, absolutely. But the true definition of a voluntary society is based on there not being any institutionalized violence. Mm-hmm. And if you look at my background's in psychology, so I like to play that card.
Yes,
sound smarter.
Please, yes.
But I consider the psychological dynamics of human evolution as well, and how technology drives that. Connectedness and self-awareness are the reason we are living in the most peaceful times in human history right now. And I don't think enough libertarians take the time to step back and really appreciate this and go, wow, look at where we've come. Look at where we're going. And it's kind of hard to accept when you're embroiled in the news. And you're watching bad cop porn all the time.
Do you think that that's being threatened, though, by the way that information spreads, how quickly the speed of information moves today, like that self-awareness and connectedness?
That's how it's happening.
You think so? Because I kind of see it in some ways as an obstacle, you know, like especially self-awareness. Like you can always find a distraction from being self-aware as an individual.
We crossed that threshold probably in the 60s in America.
How so?
From that point on, most Americans could at least get on welfare and have a television.
Sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
At that point, why not? And a lot of people have. But I think that is there's sort of an historical blip there that is overshadowed by the larger trends. And even since then, self-awareness has grown, communion has grown, connectedness has grown. How many people who have been inclined to violence because of negative feelings have now been able to connect with people in a way like never before in order to seek the therapy that they need?
Okay, all right. So let's focus, because now I'm starting to see, like, I see it like the whole society in this technology problem. But let's just go to, like, say, high school kids, like young people. And something like YouTube.
Yeah, okay, the one kid at your high school who used to get beat up because he was the loner now is connected to a million other loners.
YouTube star.
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the thing. And you can take this back 1,000 years. And how many young people who lived in a village and maybe never traveled more than 20 miles away from
and
the spot they were born?
You were the only one in the universe.
And they started thinking these things like, I wonder if anybody else thinks this way. But they
get bullied back into the system.
But they just suffered in silence because they knew better than to ever say anything.
Yeah.
And today they're on YouTube, they're connected on Facebook. I just think that the way that people communicate, like you mentioned at the beginning of the show, and the way that information moves today, some people are taken out of living consciously for themselves. Mm-hmm. So it is a bit of a double-edged sword to me, but I get what you're saying, because now those, at least, and I've said that before on the show, at least young people have outlets that never existed before. It was sit down, shut up, you have detention, you get spanked, and now there's something beyond that. I mean, like, I'm old enough to remember not having an outlet like that. Like, I just had to write in a book or record into a tape recorder onto little cassette tapes, and those deteriorate. Yeah. So there was nowhere for all that angst and frustration and even curiosity about, do other people think this way? Do other people have these questions? There was nowhere for it to go.
And while we have the disadvantages of that technological superfluence of food and creature comfort and entertainment available,
yeah,
now that's being overcome. Even the effects of that are being overcome by the connectedness of the internet. You can be sitting there watching TV and you've got a smartphone in your pocket connected to everyone else on the planet who has one, and the internet and all that wealth of human knowledge. And you go, why am I fat?
Mm.
Why am I unhappy? And maybe it's that you're suffering for something in particular and you didn't know. And you look it up, and Yahoo Answers is right there, you know, and you get to see what other people are experiencing like never before, and then connect to communities. I mean, how many people now have, and I mean, just WebMD even, things, you know, searches like that, the basic availability of that. I don't think we often enough step back and appreciate this. But more importantly, the connection between self-awareness, access to information, and violence is very clear. What causes violence? And I can at least take it back to statism, make it even more clear when you look at war and the phenomenon of organized war that you could say peaked at World War II with the technological destructive capabilities of two atom bombs, right?
Mm-hmm.
But since then, has really been on the decline in terms of the scale and scope of war. And what they can get away with is getting less and less. Whereas in caveman days, perhaps, you could say, hey, those guys have a different color skin than you. They're in the next tribe over. Let's go kill them.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, even further into the future. Sure, yeah.
And that was all it took. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, even as recently as World War II, how much dehumanization of the enemy propaganda was there against the nips and the krauts and, you know, all of that, right?
Even on a larger scale, you know, you said something at the beginning of the book, I think it was in your chapter about the history of the state, how they've had to kind of backpedal from their justifications for their existence. It mirrored a video that I made like 4 years ago called I Could Just Murder You, right? Which was about the history of government on Earth. And it actually, in the video, I took it full circle, like starting with the guy hitting you with the rock, like I could just murder you, but then
there's no one else here, no one's gonna know, ever.
But at the end, it was like, oh, Obama signs executive order for a kill list. And I was like, oh, I could just murder you. And you might have even talked about this like thousands of years ago. It was like, I'm a god, so you better do what I say.
Yes, okay, the divine right of kings.
I'm not a god, but I talked to him and he picked me. And
well,
then,
George Bush got away with that too.
That's what I'm saying. It started to actually like return as the U.S. government goes into a tailspin in the last 15 years or so. You've seen some of these weird old justifications for, well, you know, I talked to God or I could just murder you, start to come back.
Well,
but it was, and then let's see, the government serves God or does the will of God, and then people are like, bullshit, okay, fine, we do the will of the people. And
right.
But
and now you have to have a certain amount, even if you talk to God, even if you have an executive order, you still have to have a certain amount of popular buy-in.
Absolutely.
And I'll tell you why. It's about the relationship of the ruling class and the enforcement class and the general public. And it used to be there was a complete disconnect at all three levels, right? The ruling class could just tell the enforcers. I mean, they were kind of together there, and public opinion didn't matter. Mm-hmm. The people couldn't ever get organized enough to refute that in any way. But as they have, that power has been more difficult to apply. And even in the last century, you look at the history of war, and obviously the enforcement and statism comes down to two classes of enforcers, cops and soldiers. That's it. You don't have cops and soldiers, you don't have the state. So if you don't have people willing to do violence against peaceful people, the state ceases to exist. It has those two forms, right? So soldiers used to be that you could get millions of gullible young men to dress up in silly costumes and meet in the middle of a field where none of them lived and kill each other for wearing different colors.
Mm-hmm, you could.
Sorry, you can't do that anymore. The worst they can get away with today is the global war on terror. And they can't even take over and destroy another country. They can destroy the military, sort of, and occupy it. But you look at even the scope and the scale of the destruction of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, really the occupations, doesn't even hold a candle to what we saw in Vietnam just a few decades ago,
scope-wise,
World War II, right?
Oh, my, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's because you cannot get away with what you used to get away with. And look at how they try to get a war going with Syria. Now, I was very involved in the anti-war movement starting in 2007, and we had almost zero effect on policy. The anti-war movement really was an anti-Bush movement, totally fell for Obama's bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw after he got elected, once he started running, they disappeared. And Obama tried to keep the war in Iraq going longer than Bush, and we see now with ISIS and all that crap that it's, you know, they're still continuing that racket. But because people will not admit they're making a mistake while they're making it, but sometimes when the consequences are painful enough, we'll admit it later. It seems like that's what's happened with Iraq. And so when Obama tried to get boots on the ground in Syria, even with that excuse, and it wasn't, oh, all those Syrians are evil, crazy, racist, whatever, people that hate America and are coming to destroy us, so we got to go destroy them. It was, oh, we're going to go help somehow. You know, it's a UN kind of peacekeeping, whatever mission. And still, what happened? The troops, soldiers' wives on social media had those silly little placards they held up, you know, I did not enlist to fight for Al-Qaeda in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Iran. They've been trying to get a war going in Iran. And for a decade now, more?
At least, yeah.
I mean, since the 50s, maybe? You want to go back to 1953? But actually trying to get like a ground war in the modern era around nuclear weapons and all of that.
12 years, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You think they could get an American soldier to go kill a random Iranian soldier when he can talk to him on Skype? You know,
yeah,
like
it does seem
on?
Like the whole foreign policy agenda post 9/11, and even for some people before 9/11, just ran into like wet tar, basically, with the information age.
Yeah.
You know, and
that's a beautiful way of saying it.
And I don't know if there were people who had this foreign policy agenda that just didn't anticipate this kind of pushback. I mean, it seems like people who are sympathetic, maybe not to the neoconservatives, but have their own designs for the world, like Zbigniew Brzezinski. I mean, he was talking about this in the early 70s, you know, the dangers of a technotronic era and what it meant for the public consciousness. So you have to
they
think
couldn't
that,
be controlled.
You would, but well, they were also like, but on the other hand, this could be how we control everybody. And, you know, that's happening, I think, too. Yeah,
while technology empowers certain forms of control and statism, technology has always empowered people to assert freedom over control.
I tend to agree. Yeah.
Well, is there an exception? challenge you. I mean, weapons of destruction, perhaps. Weapons of large-scale destruction, I think, would be the only exception.
I think a lot of it, for me, is it's a resource problem, where the government takes money by force. And because they have those resources, these technologies that we enjoy today are developed first, usually in secret. They have access to them in secret. The scope and scale of the NSA is still unfolding, and people are still trying to comprehend exactly what they can do and what they're able to do. There are challenges with technology, but I generally agree with what you're saying, because there's more of us and there's people who want to use it for their own freedom and empowerment.
This goes in hand just with productivity and being able to take care of ourselves in general. But there's and one of the things that I do in the stump speech that I've been doing for our American Campfire Freedom Tour is I get to ask people, you know, what do you notice that people are doing differently in their daily lives as a result of the awareness of the message of freedom? And it's such a fun conversation. You hear all the different things like, oh, unschooling their kids or growing their own food or being more conscientious consumers and all that. And sometimes people are, the two big ones that people are afraid to talk about is not paying taxes and doing drugs. Mm-hmm. And there is a real psychedelic revival going on in America today, as we are at the end of the beginning of the end of the war on drugs, as we see marijuana legalization dominoes falling one after another, and the acceptance of the self-ownership that comes with that. I mean, that's what's so cool about seeing this. It's not, kids aren't saying, well, pot should be legal because it's safer than alcohol. No, screw that. Pot should be legal because you get to decide what the hell you put in your own body. Mm-hmm. And that's so beautiful to see. And hand in hand with that is this psychedelic self-awareness that's coming about as well. And I'm always excited to ask the question, because people talk about health and fitness, and I'm very into that. I've been doing yoga pretty consistently for the last 8 months, and it's been an amazing part of my own self-growth. And for those who don't know, yoga was originally developed as a warm-up for meditation. Are you a yogi? Brogi?
Not yet.
No?
Meditation I have been doing.
Well, everybody owes it to themselves to try yoga at least a few times. And I say a few times because there are different styles that meet different people's needs. There are very calm, you know, restorative, very meditative classes. Then there are like hot yoga that's really intense, physical. But every good session ends with a 10 to 15 minute just lying meditation at the end, when you're at that state of exhaustion and connectedness to your body. And it's a really beautiful experience. And I do this during the speech. I say, do you guys want to feel a little more free in the next 30 seconds? Are you ready? Are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm ready now. Yeah.
All right. Close your eyes.
All right.
Take a deep breath in and consider for just a moment that everything is right in the universe. And slowly exhale and open your eyes. And that feeling is emotional freedom. Because if everything is right in the universe, there's a certain amount of self-acceptance that comes with that. Everything is right about you. Everything that's wrong with your body is just the way it should be. Everything that is troubling your mind is all right. And the person who gets that, whether they get it from psychedelics or the message of freedom itself, or from working out, or from yoga, or from running, or from unschooling their kids and seeing the smile on a baby's face that they helped create, that person can no longer be manipulated by fear. That person is impervious to government propaganda. That person is impervious to all external manipulations by other people, all emotional control that others would try to use as leverage over you to exploit you. Doesn't work anymore.
So what I would add to that, and that's a nice exercise for sure, everything is right with the universe right now. Mm-hmm. There's truth to that if I change the language, right? Like, everything that's going on right now is the effect of previous causes. At this point, we can do nothing about, right? So we accept that.
Sure.
But then moving forward,
we You got have, the point. You
yeah,
like different
exactly.
wording.
Right,
okay.
Right.
No, and there's different wording that speaks more precisely to everyone, but you can describe it in a lot of different ways, whether that's just acceptance of everything. If everything is right in the universe, everything is as it should be, there's nothing you can do about it. Close your eyes, take a deep breath, and just appreciate that. And there's, in that moment, there's nothing else you can do but appreciate being alive and appreciate reality that you get to enjoy as a conscious human being.
But that appreciation can also be a springboard for assertiveness and action, right? We did a series on self-esteem, and I did take some criticism. So this is just like accept everything passively.
Bend over and take it?
That's what they made it about in the 70s, the self-esteem movement. But we used Nathaniel Brandon's book, The Six Pillars. Have you ever, are you familiar with that?
Only a little.
Yeah, that's a fantastic resource. You know, and it talks about, you know, living consciously, self-acceptance, taking responsibility, right? So you live consciously and you accept what is, but then you take responsibility, you assert yourself, mm-hmm. you live purposefully, and you live with integrity. Mm-hmm. And it's a great message. It's a great flow.
It's living fearless.
It can become that, sure, yeah.
Well, I think it has to. Because if you really have perfect self-esteem, even, what is fear? You know, like, fear is an emotional response. And this isn't about killing your emotions or destroying them.
Right.
But having them serve you instead of control you. And so we have emotional responses still. You can be very passionate. You can have great emotions of fear and pain and loss. But then you do with them what you want to do with them. The emotions are your brain's way of communicating something to your consciousness that it can't do all the calculations for to maybe express clearly. You know, fear is fight or flight. And it's a good thing that we experience fear. It's a good thing that when government says, we're going to bomb someone, that there is a twinge of fear. Mm-hmm. It's a bad thing when you stay in that state of fear.
When it runs your life.
And to separate a reaction from a state of being.
Right.
And that's that kind of enlightenment that comes with that self-acceptance.
Just what I said a minute ago reminded me, too, that we also drew a little criticism recently for talking about the emotional world of people, that it was not rational. Essentially, and we need to be completely rational. And I've even said things on the show before, like, they try to get us to think emotionally, or they put us in this emotional state so we can never think rationally. And I think we can be rational while recognizing that we are very emotional. And
absolutely,
the emotions are important, because if emotions don't matter and we are all just purely rational, freedom doesn't matter either. You know, if it's just about like, all science, yeah. Turn it over to the early 20th century progressives. Yeah. They had a plan to scientifically manage us. If it's all rational, yeah. Just let them, because freedom is very much an emotional thing. And that's why I appreciate you touching on it in the book. And it's that kind of freedom that I think we need first, even though, yeah, we do have these ambitions to see a freer world.
Well,
economically,
what business do you have sharing any truth with another human being if it's made your life worse?
Oh, that's true. Well, yeah, that's true. And a lot of this stuff, a lot of this information, if you don't have the foundation to deal with it, it can initially make your life more stressful. Mm-hmm. It can make you more angry. It can hinder your ability to communicate peacefully and effectively with other people.
Well, everybody's brought down when they start paying attention. Nobody goes, gee, the world's more screwed up than I ever imagined possible. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the Matrix where it's like, so we just live in a sewer. Like, we just live in a sewer where robots try to kill us. And then, you're just stuck there, you know? Yeah.
Well, that's the thing about giving people this, is it pulls them past that. Because, if I may, about winning converts, mm-hmm. We get sucked into thinking that this is a political movement, and it's not. If politics is the conversation of who do you point the guns of government at to organize society, this is an anti-political movement from its premise of saying, no, that's not acceptable. This is a philosophy movement, an ethics movement, a morals movement. You don't win supporters or voters or petition signatures or debates. We win converts to a different way of thinking. And you don't do that with that negativity. If you're feeling angry, and everybody's felt angry. If you're not angry, it's like if you don't have that reaction, you're not human. If you're not sad, if you don't mourn for the loss of all the lives and productivity and opportunity that statism has cost us, if you're not afraid for the first time maybe of the right things when you realize you're 50 times more likely to be killed by a cop than a terrorist, but then what do we do with that? We go out on the street corner with our signs and our bullhorns and yell, now join me in my anger and my fear and my depression. Everybody says, screw you.
Right.
I'm so guilty of this myself. And the kind of ego-driven, headline-grabbing activism that I'm known for is what comes out of that negativity. But when you get it from, wow, hey, this is something beautiful that I figured out that's made my life better. By the way, it could solve a lot of the world's problems. But hey, do you want to be happier and more free? No one's going to come back with, oh, happy and free? I don't know about that. Who's going to build the roads?
Yeah.
You just don't get that objection anymore. It's like the people who came up with hygiene, people who invented, whoever was the first people who came up with brushing your teeth. They didn't have to argue with people. Do you want your teeth to fall out or not? Dumbass?
Well, it's like, you know, being a good example too, right? Where you can make that argument and be like, oh, well, I'm the guy who has teeth.
Yeah,
I'm the guy who chews my food.
I'm the guy who's happy, who lives free.
Yeah.
You want some of this?
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And if we can't do that, like what? We're sharing negativity. We're never going to reach, like, you know, the consensus that I've got from this tour and asking people everywhere we go of how many of us are there. And I like to tell the joke about Sam Konkin or Sam Konkin's joke. You know Konkin, right?
Samuel Konkin the Third.
Yeah.
Yep. Sure.
He said there were two definitions of libertarian. One, anybody who calls themselves libertarian, right? And then you get, you know, on one hand, Bill Maher on the left hand, Glenn Beck, you know, who call themselves libertarian. You're like, is it meaningless? And then the second definition is anyone who agrees with me on absolutely everything. And you know that guy. But mm-hmm. I like to define it a little more functionally as people who can articulate freedom as a principle and at least attempt to apply it consistently. And we will all come to different conclusions from that. We have to accept people who are going to have different conclusions that they come to. But of people who meet that definition, and I would say that's one form of defining voluntarism, we really are only about 1 million Americans. A third of a percent. Yeah.
Well, yeah, actually that's believable.
And you take it back, you go, how many were there in the year 2000? And then you get to make some really fun, exciting projections about how we get to grow in the next couple of decades. And this takes it back to the inevitability of this. Is it inevitable? Absolutely. Because the curves of the asymptote, as I describe in the book, of productivity, connectedness, life expectancy, you know, we're now at longevity escape velocity. If you're young and healthy today, you will not die of old age unless you choose to. Congratulations, Brett, you made it. Productivity, computing power that drives all of this now, Moore's Law being clearly exponential, mm-hmm. right? So how soon can this happen? And that's what motivates me. So when you get past all that negativity and you just, wow, hey, this is cool. Being a libertarian is freaking awesome. We make better lovers too. What do you know? Like, hey, we're cooler to hang out with. Like, we're nicer people. You'd rather do business with someone who has this mentality than someone who doesn't. How about that?
Yeah.
That's what you want to share. And you don't have to argue with people anymore. If you're arguing with people, you're not doing it right. You're not sharing something of value. You're trying to boost your own ego. And that's such an important temptation to recognize, because there's, you know, you wake up and you go, oh, crap, am I the only one? And you want to look around and be like, well, at least I'm going to listen to a podcast that's going to reaffirm how right I am about everything every day. And that was a lot of the crap I was doing.
Well, what do you do now when you run into somebody who wants to be confrontational with you? Do you engage them?
And I find it so effective. You know, there are a lot of people who use social media very ineffectively. Their entire social media presence is based on ego gratification, getting likes, shares, thumbs up, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And it's, oh, other people think I'm right, and I'm going to build a big club of people who agree with me that I'm right. And when people confront them and they come at them with a negative emotion, they say, screw you, and they argue with them and push them away. And nonviolent communication teaches you to listen empathically and to understand the feelings and needs behind what someone is expressing. And when someone says, we couldn't possibly survive without a military, it's such a dangerous world, you know, it's okay, so you're afraid. What are you really afraid of? And then you can start to, you're empathizing with them. Instead of saying, you're wrong because the threats are really like this, they, you know, if you say, okay, so what are you really afraid of? And you lead them, and it's actually a better jumping off. Like, I'm pretty well known for my Socratic dialogues on YouTube,
on the street,
man on the street stuff. Yep. And I often use those to just make people look stupid. And it's like, to the message is more to the audience, like, hey, don't be this guy.
Right.
But recently, like with the American Sniper video that we did that was so successful, that was 30 minutes long, it was completing that conversation. What I found is that empathizing with people first guarantees they're going to have a better engagement in a Socratic dialogue. They're going to see it through more often. And so I do this on Instagram now. I used to follow everybody who followed me, and now when I go through my feed, I try to unfollow people that have crap in there, you know, they're posting stupid stuff. And I'll come across kids who are going to join the military and go, or you know, freedom patriots. And just so it's clear, there's a section here on patriotism that describes how, you know, a free person doesn't allow a government or an external authority to tell you who or what you choose to love. So the more patriotic you are, the less free you are, because it's choosing love based on a country that is defined by government. And I see people with, you know, crazy stuff like, I love freedom, so I'm going to become a cop. And it's like, whoa. And 5 years ago, you know what my response would be? Like, either just cut them out or yell at them. or embarrass them.
So let's go to now, right? And let's wind it back to talking about nonviolent communication. And this also brings in my problem with the speed of information and communication. Somebody says, we need the military so we can be safe. I say, oh, I'm going to use NBC here. I see you're afraid. Their reply, fuck you. Right? So we see that there's when we're actually going to try and connect with people,
you have to be careful with the vernacular.
We can't be good at social media anymore, because we actually have to like take the time to let the process of communication unfold. You can't just diagnose the person and say, oh, you're afraid. I mean, you could.
Because that's it's not really NVC to say you're afraid.
Right.
NVC is to ask and confirm.
Okay.
When you hear a negative expression and you want to suggest something. So if someone says, we need a military to protect us, you say, you know, you don't have to jump to the emotional side.
That's what
of
I
that,
just wanted
but
to
it's,
clarify.
It's,
yeah.
it's using the tactical directions and procedures of NVC to get to what is behind this. What is your concern, really? So your concern for American safety. Oh, so you're afraid that – it's not – you're afraid, you're a coward.
Yeah.
Because if you jump to the emotional analysis, that's how it can be heard as. But again, it's not the public conversations. It's not the comment sections. It's when you can use that to start the one-on-one conversation separately. And
which is really the only place I think that kind of communication can happen and where it needs to happen. And like I've said so many times on the show before, people have to do it with themselves first so they understand what their motivations are. They know why they're there. They know they're not there. If they're there to just, you know, show off and win debates and win sycophants, then they're there for the wrong reasons if they're going to ultimately try to connect with people. So knowing your own motivations gives you stable ground to stand on for understanding somebody else's motivations.
And again, for activists, having that self-awareness of what of their ego is driving their activism is very important. For me, even in the last year, my experience with psychedelics has been very helpful in separating that. The main thing, though, was the book, actually. Having written the book and going, oh, shit, I need to live up to this. You know, this perfect message.
That is a thing, yeah.
And it's challenged me to live up to it. Psychedelics have helped separate me in a way from certain elements of my ego that have been very helpful. But like I was saying, even on Twitter now, like with public comments, even if you only go halfway into NVC with it, it's so much more effective in exposing the wrongness of another person to, instead of be, oh, someone's being angry and confrontive, or confrontational, I'm going to be angry and confrontational back. Even in the world of snarky conversations, you know, the first person who stops arguing is usually the first person who wins.
The calmest guy isn't
usually
losing.
And I've always been known for staying calm. But I'll be calm and then say, okay, let me calmly compose the most powerful way for me to say, fuck you!
Yeah.
And here's a shotgun, right?
Yeah.
And now it's more, well, no, now I'm really coming from a place of inner peace. And if I want to play a little judo game with you and just expose you because you're just a Twitter troll, I'm actually more effective even in that conversation. At least thinking through the NVC angle of, you know, what is this person coming from? So, like, if someone is, and maybe here's a more typical explanation. Someone says, you know, fuck queers, gay marriage is an abomination. And you go, you know, you might say, well, I'm going to stay calm and assert, well, why do you feel that way? Like, well, really, shouldn't we respect the rights of others? But if you're going to NVC and you're going, let me empathize. Let me understand where this is coming from. And then you can say something snarky like, gee, I'm sorry you're so insecure about your sexuality that you see gay marriage as a threat.
Well, that's...
No, that's not to work on that person.
Okay.
But to at least get to a deeper level of the conversation. And maybe it's not for their benefit. Maybe you're not working on that person. Maybe then it's, don't be this guy. But you get to make a much more important point than something that people who already agree with you already understand.
Well,
you know, what good is it to tell a statist they're wrong or even convince a statist they're wrong if it doesn't make them less violent?
Well, okay, so there's times for this more connected communication, right, where you really do, and we all are in this because of our own need for efficacy. You know, we want to be effective persuaders, you know, and we want to win converts. So there are times
where
we
also want to get laid more. I mean, there aren't enough women.
Some of us do. Yeah, some of us do. And then there are other times where we're talking with somebody.
I make that joke just to point out the universality of the value of nonviolent communication in every field of human endeavors that involve working with other people.
Sure. Sure. But so we want to use that sometimes. But then there's other times where we're interacting with somebody And we're like, oh, okay, I see. You're more of like a pinata, right? That I want to hit right. So everybody watching can get this candy, you know,
right. Or a prop. And that's like what I do with the man on the street interviews.
Exactly.
Just making people look stupid. But even then, rarely is that the case yes, NVC takes time. And it's funny, having read Marshall Rosenberg's book for the second time now, I'm halfway through my second reading. One of the important tactics of nonviolent communication is repeating what the other person said and making sure that you understood what they were saying. And obviously in, you know, public social media conversations, you don't really do this. But
sure.
in one-on-one conversations, you say, hey, so I hear you saying this. Is that correct? And you think, oh, that slows things down. No, sorry. People are naturally such bad communicators. He has shown statistically in union contract negotiations, and I'm not trying to step into that world at all, just right. as an example of this principle, that when negotiators repeat everything said by the other person, it reduces negotiation time because confusion takes longer than clarification. Every single time, we assume that we're hearing correctly, and even just giving people the acknowledgement, you are being heard correctly. I'm asking to make sure, but not only am I just clarifying for myself, but I am giving you an incredible gift of reassurance that you are heard and understood, and that's so powerful and something that is really missed in the way we communicate today.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree, especially through that online form.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's more like TR semicolon DL.
Yeah, right. Well, I do ask people in conversation, even like, are you saying this? Or, you know, I usually take it, you want to take it to the next point, but, you know, I could pull up conversations on Instagram I'm having with people who are like, well, I'm joining the Marines because I love freedom in America.
Yeah.
Oh, what's freedom? You know? Oh, so you have a real desire, you know, and what I connect it to, like, this isn't really a typical application of NVC, but I would even preemptively to start the conversation, start with empathy. And it's, oh, so you really want to serve your country. You really want to do good. You want to help people be safe. And, you know, I have some experience with that because that's, you know, how I felt when I enlisted at 17. And if you had had that conversation with me at 17, I'd be like, oh, you want to serve people. You want to help people. Is this really the most effective way of doing it? And if I may bring it back to the school sucks theme, mm-hmm. you know, it's like even a lot of people say, well, the only time it's worth really going to school and higher education is if you want to be a doctor or a lawyer. But even then, if you were talking to a high school kid, oh, so you want to be a lawyer because you want to fight for justice? You want to make the world a more equitable place in that sense? Do you really think that going to school for 7 more years versus just jumping into it and doing something effective to help people right away and change the way society is organized as soon as you graduate from high school, or even right now, you don't think that would be more effective than doing what society says is what you're going to do to fight for justice, or even being a doctor?
Yeah.
You want to make people healthier. Really? I think you'd have more good as a dietitian in America these days doing individual consulting than going to 7 years or whatever it is of medical school, or undergrad plus med school plus residency, and then being able to push pharmaceuticals for the rest of your life.
So a lot of these conversations, they have two components. There's an intellectual one and there's an emotional one, but they both start with identification. So like
yes.
in the intellectual
yes.
one,
empathy.
We say, what is freedom, right? What do you mean you want to help? You know,
yeah.
and just
yeah.
like, let's find out before we start trying to have like a connection that leads us to some kind of progress here. Let's find out if we speak the same language. And that's more intellectual,
even,
I think.
Even before that, I think empathy comes before that. Hey, I'm a human being. You're a human
okay,
being.
Okay, sure.
You
yeah.
like air and food and water and love and affection and helping serve other people, right?
So they go back and forth, or maybe they can work together. Maybe
yeah,
one doesn't have to
it's
come
not,
before
it's
the
not,
other.
There's no strict formula.
Sure. So did we get to any of my notes? No, not really, but that's fine.
Dude, you want to hit some, do a speed round here?
No, you know, actually we covered these things. A lot of these things came up in the conversation. You know, I mean, the book is set up, it's 10 chapters, right?
Yep.
So it starts with the philosophy of liberty and then it moves into the history of the state. And then it goes through several theaters in the battle of the state versus freedom, including
war,
things like
personal yeah. security, taxation, economics, other destructive rackets, government and love. And again, this is one that was, you know, a little just in putting stuff together. This has to go in the book. This has. Well, let's make it a chapter then. And then 9, my favorite is true personal freedom. And the really fun one, 10, the future of freedom, which has the asymptote, the internet effect, the paradigm shift, education, activism and agorism. And localization. And if I may, just one more thing about that I do think is a little bit of an original contribution from myself here. Again, not really any original idea, but presenting it as this. When libertarians really don't get challenged enough on the things that matter to the mainstream of society, because we don't really invite it. But I think a lot of people would ask, well, where is this going?
Mm-hmm.
And from the conclusions I've come to from my analysis, localization is how government ends. If these central systems really are unsustainable, they're going to fall apart from the top down. The only question is it going to be deliberate and peaceful and orderly, or is it going to be chaotic and disorderly and painful for a lot of people? And the more deliberate and direct we can be about it, the more people we can get on board before these systems hit points of collapse, the safer it can be.
So smaller, stronger pieces is essentially what you're saying. You had a line in the book, something like revolution, it was a good line, revolution without the evolution of thought is just going to create this fear and power vacuum, essentially, where, and that's happened, you know, all throughout the world,
yep.
Certainly in the last couple hundred years. So, and somebody rises up, says, like, I'm pretty much the worst and most ruthless guy, so maybe this is a job for me to get rid of all this chaos. I would be really fearful in the whole button pushing scenario of something far worse, like if doomsday preppers, like the hordes that go around waiting for the apocalypse to happen so they can just start preying on other human beings. They'd make a good government, you know. So that kind of revolution without the evolution of thought is definitely a terrifying prospect. But
waiting for the collapse is not an answer.
Yeah, things like agorism and localization are at least ways to head that off. And
absolutely.
I think that's important that it's included there at the end of the book.
Well, if I may just finish with one thing, then this is the challenge that I've been issuing to everybody since we wrote this book, which is to read it.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, holy crap, you got to twist people's arm to get them to read a book these days. But it's 2015. You can listen to an audiobook and tell people that you read it. You
can listen to it on 1.25 like I did. It was easy.
Less than 3 hours. And it's free in every format possible. So the challenge isn't to read it and get through it. That, hopefully, if you're listening, that's the easy part. You just listen to an hour podcast. You can listen to a 3-hour audiobook that you can shorten down to 2.5 hours.
Yep.
But read it and decide for yourself if it's not the quickest way for you to take someone else from zero to I get it. If it's not an effective tool for you to share this message, to wake people up. And I got to say, the most satisfying feedback I get is from people saying, you won me as a convert. You changed my mind. And it's even better from people that I know, from my mom and my dad, and watching my brothers come around slowly. You know, people in my life, old friends even. And if it's not the most effective way for you to take the people around you who you love from zero to I get it, to share something that you love with the people around you. And I mean, what business do you have yelling on a street corner if you haven't convinced your family of this most important truth, right? So, okay, yeah, some family members you can reach and share and give them their 10 years to figure it out.
There's other challenges too, like, hey, I saw you shit yourself, so shut up. You know, like when it's older family members, there are tricks, right?
What are,
like,
you going to tell me? Well, yeah. Again, that's why being able to hand someone a book or ask someone to even read one section, say, hey, Grandpa, this is, you know, this is something that is really important to me. I just read this book and it's really, really valuable. And if you love me, you know, I'll give you the same amount of time to appreciate something that you love. But if you would take 10 minutes and read the first chapter, I would really appreciate it. Just so you understand why this is important to me and where I'm coming from politically or philosophically or ever, however you want to present it, right?
Yeah.
And that's why it's such a good tool, is the first chapter contains the entire philosophy. You can hand it to someone who's dealing with a particular issue and say, just read this one page or two page section and let me know what you think. I'd love to talk to you about this. If it's someone you care about, you have to be able to share things that you're passionate about with them.
Amen.
And if this book isn't it for you, then find what is. Because I guarantee that is what you'll get the most satisfaction from.
Yeah, and you probably want people to let you know, too, if it isn't that book and why, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. If you find other methods, we know that producing media wakes people up. I know that it provides important gateways. We know that running for office even can get people the spark or the interest that they need to pull them out of the matrix. But, you know, really what it comes down to is winning converts. And I know that my channel, my YouTube channel, has, you know, with 3,000 videos, has won thousands of converts because, you know, we meet them every day. We get emails from people. But I'm pretty confident that it's not the most efficient. And if we really care about this, we have to be as ruthless in analyzing our activism as we are in the state or the economy or anything else.
Yeah.
And when we are, that's how we maximize value. And capitalism, self-ownership, is really not about counting value in dollars, but in human happiness.
Well said. So your website, if people want to check you out, is thefreedomline.com, correct?
Thank you. Yes, that's it. How did I forget?
And can you tell us a little bit about what brings you to Manchester, New Hampshire today, this Campfire book tour? Like, if people, there's still a ways to go on this,
yes,
right? You still have to
yes.
swing down south and out west. So
we're halfway through the American Campfire Freedom Tour, which is really a big piece of false advertising. It's actually the Adam Kokesh Avoids His Probation Officer Tour. We have had a few campfires, though, and it's been a lot of fun. And we've invited people last year to support this by donating to our crowdfunder that made this possible. So we're doing a lot of individual deliveries for $100. We're going to come to your door with a t-shirt and a signed book and sticker and whatever else for merch goodies we can give you, and let you sign the trailer that we're traveling. My girlfriend, my fiance now, and I.
Congrats.
Thank you. As of just 2 days ago. And we are traveling the country with my dog, Baloo. And people are invited to come sign our trailer and host events in their backyard. And so we've done a lot of backyard campfire events. We started in California. Our first drop was at Camp Pendleton. We actually drove onto the base.
Wow.
And had a lot of fun with that. And then we went up through, well, I won't bore you with, but we did the lower part of the tour across first Utah, Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, New Orleans, Louisiana, Florida, Georgia. And then we did this funny curve up north to Porkfest for New Hampshire. And now we're in Manchester. We're doing New England in July. Then we do this crazy swing through the Bible Belt up to northern Midwest in August and the West Coast in September. And if I may, this so for people who want to check that out, thefreedomline.com, we've got all our dates there. Free books and stickers at every stop. I'd love to meet you anywhere on the road. And if I may, I have some really exciting plans after this as well.
Yeah.
And there are sort of two great contradictions in the libertarian movement right now. One is, we want government to have as small a role in your life as possible, but we want to talk about it all the time, you know? And for me, it was very disingenuous to do a 3-hour daily news podcast talking about all the evils of government and watching bad cop porn and all of that.
Yeah.
So getting to, no, read the book, get the message, and get on with your life and enjoy it, you know? And that's really important. But the other one is that we say that freedom is the maximum good for human happiness, and then we sit in the most statist environments, and we work 9-to-5s, and we pay rent and taxes and deal with all of that. And what I've seen that has been so beautiful while we've been on this tour is that so many libertarians are groping towards a lifestyle based on these values. And it's tough when you live in a city and you start a garden, but you can't have chickens because you're neighbors, or you unschool your kids, but now you're fighting the state all the time and you got to worry about CPS, or, you know, you're doing barter, but you still end up paying taxes in so many other ways in your lifestyle. And one giant leap of lifestyle change away in what I would call homesteading, you're able to live maybe instead of, you know, 5%, 10% by these values, you can go up to 90, 95%, where maybe your only interaction with the state is, you know, vehicle registration, your driver's license, and you pay your property tax once a year. But then other than that, you know, if you can feed yourself because you've got a garden and animals and you've got off-grid power and water collection and all of that. So I'm actually taking the Earthship Academy seminar in October with Mike Reynolds and Taos. I'm really excited about that. And then we're buying land near Flagstaff and hosting the Freedom Homestead Workshop in March and April of next year, during which time 12 student staff will lead 40 students through 4 construction projects, building completely off-grid homes in the mornings and spending the afternoons with expert instructors. We've got Mike Adams, Jordan Page, Cody Wilson on board already to do every single skill that you could possibly want for homesteading, from aquaponics to nonviolent communication to homemade guns to 3D printing and 3D printing guns to all the food production you could possibly imagine, everything that you would want to do to live by these values. And so if people want information about that, please check it out. That's on our website as well, thefreedomline.com.
Awesome. Hey, can we do a little lightning round here? I want to see if anybody wrote anything.
Where's your lightning round?
What's
you
that?
You got questions? Yeah, or do we
really covered
everything?
It. We actually did cover
just
everything.
Just by accident?
Yeah, I wanted to see if... Can you relay to him that he helped change my life and shake the illusion of government from my mind once and for all? But he did that as Adam versus the man, not as Adam the hippie tour bus guy.
Well.
But you did it.
It was by efficiency, you know, and I very much appreciate that. But the people who sought the message and got it by listening to me ranting on a podcast for 3 hours a day. Usually it took them a few months. At least that's the feedback that I've been getting. You don't listen to one show and then go, okay, I got it. And some people need that, but it's usually people who are seeking this out.
Mm-hmm.
We've reached all of those people. We've put it up there. The message has been out. There's been enough freedom media. What we have to do now, if we want to grow the movement, if we really care about being effective in helping this process along, making it happen as quickly as possible, advancing humanity, I mean, ending the pain of statism. Every day that the state is in existence is a day of pain and violence and suffering that can be ended one day sooner because we put our egos aside to reach new people and win converts out of the mainstream. And the way you do it more efficiently is with a book like this, with a direct communication of the message, not a political podcast, not a news podcast, not a debate, not an argument. And I know that's kind of oversimplifying what my podcast was. You know, for some people, the older they get, the stronger they were. For me, it's always like the worst, more arrogant, pathetic activist I was in the past. I'm better now. Mm-hmm. But I always feel like I'm making this progress. And I know I'm very confident in saying that what I'm doing now is far more efficient in terms of winning converts and asking for donations to be able to support what I do, which makes it all possible. I feel much better about it now. You know, when maybe it was something in the back of my mind in the past, like, well, I'm doing this out of ego, so maybe if I'm asking for donations for people to help me blow up my ego, that's, you know, not as good as, you know, what I could be doing. And I think now when I ask people for money now and I say, you know what, we need your support. This is made possible. This tour has been made possible. Giving away free books everywhere we go has been made possible because people donated because they cared about this message. I can say genuinely I've set my ego aside and I'm doing at least as best as I can see right now what I believe is the most effective way to win converts to the message, which is the most important thing we need to do to build a free society.
Right. I think most of the other questions here you
boxers
answered.
Or briefs?
No. Would you push Rothbard's button? I think we dealt with that indirectly. But
in the state immediately?
But you also in the book recognize that...
That's not reality.
Right. Still running for president in 2020.
Yeah, if the pieces fall into place, and it's very exciting to see that there are enough people who support that. We're talking about, you know, 4 years before we even really get started with this. But freedom is actually the first in a series of the Encyclopedia of Freedom. The next one is going to be Thinking Freedom, about thinking more rationally and dealing with emotions appropriately and communicating from that. It seems like a lot of people are taught, you know, as you know, what to think rather than how to think. So it's the practical 100-page guide to thinking for yourself. And then Living Freedom, which is about the lifestyle and homesteading. And we have a couple others we'd like to do. But in 2019, I'll be writing American Freedom, which is how you would dismantle the entire American federal government in 4 years. And
not in a 100-page book.
Yes.
No
100-page
shit.
Book. We're going to get it down to it. Now, this is something I don't know the answers to. And I'm very looking forward to doing the research and bringing the experts together to analyzing the entire structure of the federal government. And even if I don't end up running, working towards getting this message out and planting the flag on the idea is a very worthwhile endeavor. And that'll be, you know, a few years away. We're going to keep building our base. We're going to keep winning converts. We're going to keep getting the book out. And if we have enough people on board, I think when 2020 rolls around, we're going to be in a position to plant the flag nationally on this idea of the platform of dissolving the entire federal government over 4 years. And I don't think we have a chance of winning in 2020. I really don't. I think it would be an amazing thing for someone to win the Libertarian nomination with this platform and to get 3 or 5%. I think that's very reasonable. I think as much as the movement's growing, you know, from Gary Johnson's 1% or so, we can do, I think with whatever. And I hope he gets the nomination in 2016. I think he's the best candidate, although I know he's not really a voluntarist. I think he's... as far as anyone out there, I'd be looking forward to seeing someone who can speak to the message better. But in terms of credibility, he's an amazing candidate. He's a friend of mine. I think he's a great guy. The resume speaks for itself as the governor who vetoed more bills in 2 terms than all other governors combined during that time. Although, I got to say, the ridiculous legislature in New Mexico certainly helped with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in 2020, there's going to be a chance to do that. And if I get the chance again in 2024, I think you're going to be whoever's on this platform at that point is going to be a contender. And maybe by 2028, we'll have someone who could actually win by this. I really hope it's not me, actually. What I want to do is run in 2020 and then have 2024 be a dozen people who are actually more qualified than me running on the same platform. And I can just take credit as the guy who got the ball rolling on that and didn't have to oversee the administrative process.
Sure.
You know, one of the nice things about running this way is that it will all be on a very specific platform. and it won't matter who wins. It won't matter if I get assassinated the first day in office, because the vice president will step up and go, all right, page two, here's what we're doing. And it will have been because there was a national consensus. And I think that's what's important about the political process, is that it's a way of measuring consensus right now about how violence is applied. And if we say, all right, violence at this level, at least we can do away with it. We have a plan. We can make it go away in 4 years and at least get it down to the state level. And of course, that's the start of localization that keeps going down to the counties, to the cities, to the point at which we can transition to truly nonviolent systems of ownership and respect for individual rights. But it's right now, I'm very confident again that I don't have to compromise anything I'm doing to do that, and I wouldn't. It's really still just, how do we win converts? How do we increase freedom? How do we show people to live more free and give them something of value?
Last one here. What are some of the most important lessons you've learned in becoming an activist? We just talked about that for the last hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, putting the ego aside has been the biggest, hardest thing. There's so many other practical things about civil disobedience and media production. And I learned a lot from the lefties in the anti-war movement about that, and bringing that civil disobedience to more libertarian causes has given me a bit of a corner on a certain market as an activist, or at least for a while has given me a certain notoriety. But the most important thing is taking the ego out of it, really. My process was 10 years just to get the philosophy down, just to really accept it. And, you could describe that as the one most important journey, but the thing I like to say is the only time you're wrong is when you think you've gotten to the bottom of the rabbit hole, because there is no bottom. It just keeps going and going and going, and you get to keep learning and growing every single day.
Yeah, you can certainly always keep learning, right? That is...
Well, I've been shrinking, actually. I don't get to spend as much time in the gym on the road, but... I'm still growing in other ways.
Sure. I'm just thinking now, shrinking. Who was shrinking? You said rabbit hole. And then there was someone who was shrinking in Alice in Wonderland. And I was wondering if you were trying to...
No, it was just because last time we hung out, you were like, man, you used to be bigger. And I was like, oh, yeah.
You look good, Adam. And you seem...
You're getting bigger. You're getting all my muscle that I'm leaving behind.
And you seem a lot happier than when I met you a couple years ago.
Yeah.
You know? And that's great. I'm happy to see that, too.
Thank you.
And, I certainly appreciate the time we've been able to spend together. I appreciated you inviting me to participate in your roast event at Pork Fest. That was awesome.
It's online now. You're famous.
It is. Yep. Yep. For better or for worse, it is on the internet.
Oh, that was epic. And you know what? That was doing Pork Fest for me this year was really a different experience as well, to be able to just go and enjoy it and be like, no, I'm just here as one of the guys. The only thing, if I'm going to speak, the only thing I'm going to do is set it up so people can rip on me for, for 2 hours. And it really was a beautiful thing in terms of separating ego for those of us who have the privilege of sharing a bit of the spotlight of the movement and saying that, we're just as dysfunctional assholes as all the rest of you.
We're roastable. For next year, people need to do their research on me. I got off way too easy. And thank you for coming to the School Sucks studio. It was great to have you here.
Beautiful to see again how you've progressed and developed your show as well.
Thanks. So we'll leave it there. The site again.
TheFreedomLine.com.
All right. Thanks, Adam. Done.
Cool. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us at schoolsucksproject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.